Our guest on this week's podcast comes with a coaching resume like no other. Once assistant coach with the Melbourne Storm, he went on to be assistant coach of the Australian Kangaroo national side before finding his way to Leeds and then crossing the Pennines to become head coach of a cash-strapped Warrington Wolves. He's since gone on to successful coaching and development pathways in both Scottish and Ireland Rugby Union national sides, along with Rugby Australia. It's our pleasure here at What Would Brian Bevan Say podcast to welcome Steve Anderson. G'day, Steve. How you going, mate?
Very well, thanks, guys.
Now, where do we find you, Steve? In all this lockdown, all this bizarre time during the world being upside down, where are you at the moment?
I'm in a very lovely place called Perth in Western Australia. Fantastic environment, but working for Rugby Australia.
Yeah.
So in the high performance area. So it's been tough, as for everyone, like just not being able to smell the grass, so to speak.
So there's been no training at all now, has there? It's completely away from the field.
Well, pretty much 75% of all staff were stood down by Rugby Australia, which crept into obviously the high performance area, the academy area.
Yeah.
They come back next week. So there's been a pretty much a 2.5 month shutdown at in all provinces.
And I guess like everyone else, you've just been learning as you've been going along as well. I mean, it's all been a bit crazy for everyone in our roles.
The technology has caught me out a few times. But I've become very good at Zoom and Teams. No, it's been frustrating, particularly understanding that, you know, our sport's an outdoor sport. The kids are very obviously the academy are very frustrated. As are the pro players, but they just want to get out and play.
Yeah, well, hopefully, fingers crossed, it won't be too long now. Now, thanks ever so much for coming on the podcast. Clearly, we want to talk about Warrington and that time you had there at Wilderspool all those years ago. But first of all, where did rugby league start for you?
Look, my first memory is probably as about a 6 or 7 year old playing for St. Patrick's. Probably a town called, I'll throw some names out, but Springshaw and Emerald. I'm from the western part of Queensland.
Okay, yeah.
Which is obviously a long way from the east coast. I've still got family there, probably about 5.5 hours west, if you go inland, from places like Rockhampton. Yeah. I don't know if you've heard of Rocky.
Yeah, Rockhampton, nice part of the world.
And just head west.
Yeah,
you'll hit my territory.
And you're still in Queensland after 5 hours. Gee.
Well, you're only sort of halfway through. After that, you've got a long way to the border.
Yeah, so it's pretty much Moscow to Warrington by the sounds of things.
Pretty much. But that's probably my first memory at primary school. It was Wait for Abe's then. I sort of got, more memories as you get older, of course. When I got into the junior age, I was quite fortunate. I actually love sport. It's probably pretty much all we had to do out there. There was cricket and rugby league.
Yeah, okay.
That was our choice. In the summer, you played cricket.
Yeah.
And obviously, you played rugby league in winter.
And then it was footy in the winter and that was it.
Well, we had school as well. We did a lot of athletics and stuff like that. Swimming, we got into swimming a bit, which is unusual for a Western Queensland town. But I was very fortunate that I grew up around a lot of sport. It was very easily accessible. Mm-hmm. Had some great mentors. And then when I got into junior age footy, I sort of went from, at 17 or 18, I moved out of where I was from, the Central Highlands, and I was on the journey to pursue professional rugby league. And I was one of the fortunate ones. In those days, this is pre-NRL, of course.
Right. So this was a totally different competition. Queensland had a different competition to New South Wales.
Yeah, so we aspired to play in Brisbane.
Yeah.
And those that were born in New South Wales obviously aspired to play in Sydney. So they were two very separate comps. Look, fortunately for me, I achieved that. But Sydney was always considered the number one competition, of course. And they used to rape and pillage Queensland for years. Still got it in me. I hate them. and that's how State of Origin came about.
Yeah.
As you know, it was all about bringing our own home to play and level playing field.
And showing what you were worth.
It's 2001, it's game three, the series is tied. Where do you go? Who do you pick? Alan Langer comes into the picture.
Yeah, from England. He was playing at Warrington and we were struggling. We'd had injuries, we didn't have great form, and after game two we were beaten convincingly, really, and we came back and we were playing at ANZ Stadium, and Wayne was the coach, and he's thinking we need a halfback, you know, but he kept it pretty quiet. He didn't tell a lot of people. I happened to be captain of the team, only, you know, because Alfred retired. Kevy wasn't there. Gordy was injured. So I was sort of like I was filling the void for a period of time. And he told me the night before we announced the team that he's going to bring Alf back. And I just went, wow.
The crowd to a man is standing to welcome home Alan Langer. Former Australian captain, playing his 31st Origin, 22 Test matches, 240 Premiership games, and four times a Grand Final victor. Alfie is back in town. Langer, danger. Langer's over, is he? Yes! Langer gets a try. Capping a magnificent game.
Yeah, how good's this? Alan Langer had some critics. Wayne Bennett had some critics. That just answered them.
And then I had a fantastic opportunity with the Queensland Rugby League, which I went into development, and I was working in the pathway system. And again, had some really, very good mentors. People like Wayne Bennett was in the system then. He actually started to set up in the late 80s, early 90s, what they now call the emerging origin squads. So he, even back then, he was way ahead of his time.
Really?
And he was building the layers underneath it. It was great opportunity for me as a young fella.
And I guess it was a fair bit of travelling was there involved in that, with you sort of in development. You all over the state. Gee.
So I was one of the six. There were six of us, and we were each given zones. So my zone was Southern Queensland.
Right. Yeah, which to these two in England, probably, you know, I think it's just the Isle of Wight, but I mean...
Is it not just like driving over the M62? Is it not the same?
No, that's like just a little going out for a picnic.
Oh, right.
But yeah, we did a lot of miles, and that was the start of, I think the foundation of my background is development.
Right.
And I've been very, very fortunate where I've sort of graduated through the ranks from development. I got the opportunity to coach underage at Queensland level. A great tutor there too, and Dennis Ward. He was my boss. And then from there, I morphed into coaching at a pro level with the Gold Coast. That was in 93, 94.
Yeah, and they were a long way off, I presume. I mean, clearly they're a prominent side now in the NRL, but back then they probably didn't even dream of having a team up there, did they, that was going to go to that level?
Well, at that stage, I'm showing my age here, guys. At that stage, they were in the Winfield Cup.
Right.
So in 1988, the game, as I said, expanded, and it brought in teams like Brisbane, Gold Coast, Newcastle.
Yeah.
And also North Queensland, the Cowboys. Yeah.
I seem to remember when we were growing up in Warrington in those years that the Gold Coast shirt was just brilliant. Yeah. I remember a lot of people walking around Warrington in that Gold Coast shirt of about 88. It was the one that everyone wanted.
Well, they came in 88, and I was fortunate enough to go into, I was 30, and I was the assistant coach with John Harvey.
Yeah.
And in that era, we had first team, second team, and then you had your under 21s. And they were all pro, they all travelled.
Yeah.
So obviously that changed as it became more national.
Yeah.
That was a great learning experience, very tough environment.
Yeah.
And Johnny Harvey was a sort of no-frills guy. John ended up coaching at Salford when I was over there. John did Salford in, I think, 2001, somewhere in there.
So pretty much when you were there, spot on when you were there.
Yeah, we caught up a couple of times. But that tuition, that early tuition through the Queensland Rugby League and the mentoring that I got from blokes like Dennis Ward and Bennett, and there's actually a good guy on there from England, a guy called Mike Cullen. He passed away from cancer. But he was another guy that sort of, he would have been well in his 50s then. So he took me under his wing. But so those early foundations sort of gave me the platform. And I was very fortunate. I got ushered through sort of a graduated system of learning.
Yep.
And I was fortunate because today it's commonplace where you get a pathway, so to speak, and you're mentored as a coach. But that was quite unique in that era.
Yeah. So it's a little bit higgledy-piggledy back then, but you sort of found your way through.
Well, it was sink or swim.
Right.
But I was fortunate. I had some good mentors.
And then you found yourself on the other side of Australia, I guess, with the Western Reds.
Yeah, well, when the Western Reds came about in 95, obviously I had a few guys that I knew in the system, and they approached me the back end of 94, I think it was. Yeah, it would have been, because 95 they come in. And Dean Lance was there. First off, Peter Mulholland. So Peter had him for the first 12 months, Peter Mulholland.
Yeah.
I can't remember what happened there, but then Dean come in. He spent the next 2 years there.
Right.
And once again, you know, I'm still only a kid, basically. And I've got guys like Steve Rogers, who was the footy manager. And Peter, first off, he was great. And Peter's now the talent ID guy at Canberra Raiders.
Okay, yeah. They've picked up some good players in the last few years, haven't they? So he's doing a good job.
That's Peter. He's very, very good, very astute judge. Once again, I was very fortunate.
The big men are back at the Wacker this Friday night. Back for the big game rugby league when our Western Reds take on the Sydney Roosters. Back at the Wacker, underlines to do battle in a head-to-head clash. Show your support for the Reds this Friday, and you could also win one of 200 double passes to Roadshow's new movie, Judge Dredd. Tickets at Reds and at the Wacker Friday night. Reserve graded 5, the big one at 6:30 sharp. Come catch rugby league fever this Friday night with the Reds live at the Wacker.
Super League war hit, so to speak, and split the game. So they closed down Western Reds, they closed down the Hunter Mariners, they closed down the Queensland Crushers.
Yeah.
So both sides of the debate, the ARL loyal and the Super League News Limited loyal, they had to shed teams to get it back to 16.
And shed players.
That was probably one of the but for those clubs that survived, it was quite good for it gave greater depth to each of the surviving clubs.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously the talent was spread across 21 franchises, so to speak, and then they had to get it back to 16. So basically there was something like 120 or 130 players that had played first team level that then had to go back into the system. So what it actually did, it actually pushed a lot of players back into what we now call, or what rugby league now calls, the Entrust Cup, which is the feeder system into first team in New South Wales and in Queensland. It used to be called Q Cup way back, and New South Wales Cup. But so what it did, it actually shored up the underbelly of the existing franchises, and it made the competition probably, the quality of the competition probably went up a bit.
Yeah. I guess you've got to up your game as well, and haven't you? If you're playing first grade and, you know, you look over your shoulder and there's some kid behind you who's, you know, he's lost his place in those competitions.
We sort of lost that in that Super League era.
Yeah.
Because
just diluted. Just too many players. Yeah, not the quality there.
And, but, you know, the system that I come into, as I mentioned, with Gold Coast was the old Winfield Cup, which was first, seconds and 21s.
Yeah.
Well, they virtually did away with the seconds and the 21s and just made it a real elite. Well, that was their thinking, to make it a real elite competition.
Yeah.
And you're allowed 26 players in your main salary cap, and then we won't talk about that. you're allowed a wider training group.
Yeah.
Which I think there was about 8 players in that. So there wasn't a lot that you could tamper around with. And then, but as I said, it did actually push that talent back into the Queensland and New South Wales Cups.
Mm.
And, and they fed into the NRL franchises.
Now, you're talking a lot there, Steve, about the east coast of Australia, but clearly you're over on the west coast there with the Western Reds. Were there any players that were sort of coming to fruition that were actually born or bred or, you know, come from that western side of Australia that were starting to sort of peak when it all disappeared?
Not really.
It was just AFL mad, wasn't it, over there? That's always has been.
Still is.
Yeah.
We did a lot of work in the development area.
And what happened to those kids? Were they just lost to the game?
Lost to the game. There's still a very strong, the local competition's always been here. It's been here for donkey's years, 70 years or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's more like a, it's very much a very second tier park competition now. I've been to obviously a fair few games, and the standard's not real good, but the game is still here. It still exists, which is great.
Well, what we need to do, Steve, if you find any decent players over there, clearly you can just put them through what would Brian Bevan say, and we can promote them to Super League. Isn't that the way we're going to go things, Sam?
Well, you set up your management committee now, haven't you? What do you take? How much percentage are you on? I can't remember now.
Well, he's only got Chris Sandow at the moment, so it's not looking great for him, is it?
We'll have a few more, don't you worry. So that all sort of folded then, Steve, and then you were sort of told then to head over to Melbourne. And boy, what a side Melbourne have had over the years. They've probably been the most dominant side in rugby league now for the past 20 years, I guess, if you go through the stats. Yeah,
look, once again, I mean, and I was probably spoiled again. I mean, you walk into a room. I can still remember the very first meeting we had. We never even had a field. We never had a stadium. We had nothing. We operated out of the Sun Herald building in Melbourne.
Right.
So we're on the fifth level because it was News Limited. So there was John Rebo, Chris Johns, Chris Anderson, Greg Brentnell, and me. And we had no players signed. This is September 1997. We had 13 players signed.
Right. And when's the comp about to start?
Basically March.
Right. So you've not got long.
By the 1st of March in 1998, we had 13 players signed.
That's all you need.
So I'll tell you what, we're panicking. What we're waiting for was things like, and this is the beauty of list management, and to have guys like, Johnny Rebunk and Chris Anderson in particular, and of course Johnsy, he'd come from the Broncos. So, and Greg Brentnell and I, we both had a shared sort of come from development into coaching, so to speak. Mm. And Greg obviously was a fantastic rugby league player. But having guys like Rebo sitting there, and we're panicking, we're going, we start pre-season on November 1, and we're running around with a handful of players. But what we're waiting for was through Reeves's sort of patience was what we could get out of the Hunter Mariners who were folding, and also the Crushers, also obviously the Reds. I'd already targeted the Western Reds players like the Howies and Kearns and brought a handful across. They were easy marks, but we didn't pick. We could have picked the whole team. Yeah, but we didn't. Reeves just going, no. And the recruitment side of it was one of the key, I think for me out of Melbourne, the key learning was like list management, how to actually piece together and not so much about the now. He was very interested in what we looked like. I can remember the whiteboard session we did probably day three, and he's talking about, you know, 20 years. He was talking about the investment from News Limited being 20 years, because we're all worried because of the Super League hangover, and we're all worried about a surety of position and tenure, so to speak.
You get that team on the park then in March. I mean, how did it go in those first few months?
Well, our first game, we played a trial of all places. You could win a few bets on this. Ask around, where's Melbourne Storm's first ever game? It was in Hobart in Tasmania.
Was it really? It's down there.
And we played the Adelaide Rams. The Adelaide Rams survived 1 year in 98 from all the cutting.
Yeah.
And then they left. They got booted the following year. So I mentioned salary cap before, you know, as we all had concessions. All News Limited teams had concessions coming back into the NRL, the newly formed NRL. And we had to get our cap down in 3 years to 3.25. Now, all I could say is I left in 2000, probably not anywhere near.
Yeah, they had 3 years to do it, but took 13 years to do it.
That's it. But look, as you know, like books are books. You know, you can manufacture what you like. And, you know, obviously it was a really struggle because all those wages through that period, that Super League war, both sides of the fence, they were absolutely overinflated because they were trying to buy the same product. Obviously, the winner was the player. You know, you don't begrudge the player, but some of the salaries were just ridiculous.
Kamali again to the 10-metre line. Beautiful tackle. Nickau, though, was there to support, and Nickau will be made to play the ball on five. They're 2 metres from the line. Kamali puts the kick over and across. There's a try coming. Craig Smith has put it down. Has he put it down legally?
Ooh,
was he onside?
Well,
did he get it down?
What about the high tackle from Ainscombe?
Here we go. He gets the ball first, gets hit around the head and drops the football. What to do? What does the video ref do? Does he award a penalty try?
Well, can you be absolutely certain that Craig Smith would have scored?
No, he's taking him out of the throat.
Yeah, that's a penalty try.
I think you'll find that Bill Harrigan is about to make one of the biggest calls ever been made in 100 years of rugby league. Glenn Lazarus has come back with an excited look on his face.
And Ray, a penalty try, the conversion is out where the try is scored. If it had been an 8-point try, they'd have had a kick in front of the posts. So is he given the penalty try or the 8-point try?
No, penalty try.
He's given a penalty try, and he will take the kick. He will take the kick from right in front.
In front, I'm sorry, yes.
Yes, he takes the kick from right in front, Peter. They know how important this kick is, and that guy has kicked it. The most historical grand final ever has had to be decided by, I repeat, the toughest refereeing decision that I've seen a referee undergo. Now, the trophy is going to Victoria, barring a miracle. Was there a St George player who kicked it, pulled down? Not in possession. The hooter has gone. Melbourne have won it. Melbourne have won the grand final. A sporting miracle.
From your point of view, had you picked up skills-wise, do you think, you know, at this point, you know, at Melbourne Storm, what would you be sort of considering your role to be, and where were you going personally?
Yeah, that's a good question, because I was just all about learning off people like, you know, Chris. You know, I had a really great mentor, and I was happy being his sidekick. I was his assistant coach. Did I have ambitions to be a head coach? Yeah. But I wasn't sort of pushing it, if that makes sense. I still considered myself in a learning phase. Mm-hmm. Even though I'd done head coach roles, you know, as I mentioned at Gold Coast, you know, I'm 30 years of age and I'm assistant first team coach and head coach of the seconds. You know, I'd done head coach roles, but at a professional level, I was very, you know, understanding to the fact that I had to learn. And I had a great bloke in Chris. I was like a kid in a lolly shop with Chris because he opened up so many doors for me. I had a couple of discussions with Gary Hetherington when during the World Cup. And it was Gary that sort of suggested, you know, the UK move.
So this is in what, 2000, Steve, is it, when you're assistant to the Kangaroos?
Yeah, end of the World Cup. And Gary came to our celebration.
Right.
In Leeds. And,
Let's talk about this. Come on.
And look, Gary was quite happy. He had a long chat to me. And I was still under contract to Melbourne for the following year. And this is where, you know, Reeves and that and Chris were good. Chris had the shits with me bad when because, I said I wanted to go. He had the shits with me because all of a sudden he was left having to do all the work.
Now, you know, just a second, Steve. I'll just translate what got the shits means to the two bombs. Yeah. Okay. All right. He's not eating something
presumably
dodgy.
He wasn't happy.
He's a bit pissed off.
He's not happy. Yeah. No. Yeah, we're good mates. But look, he wished me all the best, of course, but and we stayed in contact. We always have. You know, I was only talking to him the other day, but and he's always been a mentor for me. But Gary just fronted once I said, look, I'm happy to talk to Reeves, and he said, no, we'll do it now. So we got the World Cup sitting there, we've got, you know, piss flowing everywhere. And he just walked over to Reeves and said, I want to see if we can get Ando over for 12 months.
And off you went.
Yeah, and it was only a short-term deal.
Just before we go on to that, Steve, I've got to ask a question. How do you coach the Kangaroos? I mean, they're just brilliant. Yeah. I mean, I remember going to watch, I think it was with Dennis at Leeds University. Leeds were playing the Kangaroos. It would have been, what year was that, Dennis? About 94?
89.
We're going back that far.
89 to 91, I think. No, it wasn't 89. It was a bit later. It would have been 92.
92. Meninga played. Ettinghausen was playing down one side. And I remember, I think we got into the game about 5 minutes late and the score was already about Australia 20, Leeds 0. And they were playing a different game. I mean, when you see that standard, is it a completely different level to when you've been coaching at club level?
Yeah, yes and no. It depends on the group. Like even at a national level, you know, if you're blooding players, like in that group we had kids like, Nathan Hindmarsh. Nathan was a boy. Yeah. 19 and a half or something.
He's still probably making about 60 tackles a game though, isn't he?
Oh, yeah, he was a fantastic work ethic. But you know, like when you walk out on a field, a training, I can remember down at, you know, one of our first sessions at, we're based in Leeds, and we're training down at the Kirkstall down the road. And Chris wasn't there. And the beauty about Chris and I was we worked in the club with Melbourne, and we're also the national first team, the head coach and the assistant coach. So we had our we knew each other inside out. I knew what he exactly wanted in terms of the, you know, the coaching principles and what he was trying to espouse. And but getting back to what do you coach? Well, there's still it's not so much the team. It's the individual. I did a lot of work one-on-one around, you know, mainly their prep and their post-game analysis. That was sort of what I hung my hat on that side of it, and Chris was big on that. So I did a lot of work one-on-one, and that meant individual meetings all the way through. And that was about setting their match targets, looking at the previous game's edits, based on our game plan, what they wanted, what we wanted from that individual. When you're on the park, you just toss them the ball.
Slow to clear was Kearney. Johns goes to the right. Kamali inside ball for Hill. Then it goes for Darren Britt. He's only three away. Another man who would be an unlikely try scorer. Fifth tackle. Andrew Johns. And then Fittler. Here's trouble.
I mean, Darren Britt never played an Origin game.
Right, but he was in that Kangaroo side.
1998, we picked him, and we picked him all the way through.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's things like that, you know, that we were quite deliberate about what we needed for Chris's game plan to actually, you know, manifest on game day. You know, when you got a spine of, yeah, this is, you talk about the halfbacks. So we had Andrew Johns and
who?
Peter Morley.
Who?
Yeah, who?
Yeah, exactly.
Now you probably you may remember that Andrew had to play nine.
Yeah.
And Brett played halfback purely and simply because we kept combinations. So we had Brett and Scott Hill, the halves from the Melbourne Storm. So and Andrew played hooker, but he was on the park. That was the key part of it. You can't leave him out.
If you could have taken one player out of the Great Britain, it would have been Great Britain back then, wouldn't it? I don't think than England.
Yeah.
Who would you have taken? Who would you have fancied to put in that Kangaroo side? Could any of them got in, do you think?
Scunthorpe.
He's the one you want.
Oh, yeah, all day.
And a real shame he didn't come to the NRL, wasn't it? That he didn't test himself.
He would have, and that probably sounds, he would have shitted him.
Yeah. Yeah, he was tough.
He's such a good footballer. But yeah, he is. Mm-hmm. And he reminded me a lot of, in some ways, Tuera, Tuera played. And I think Scunthorpe played a fair bit of 13 as well, from memory.
He did. 13. No, he did. I've said on here before that he was the first player I saw as a 17-year-old make his debut at Warrington, and for half a season at that age was carrying the pack at that age going on to 18. Not seen anyone in the British game like that live before in the flesh.
He was exceptional. And the fact that he was a big, robust guy with speed, that's a very good mix to have as a rugby league player. Speed, size, power, strength, endurance, tough bastard. So he was one that you'd hang your hat on.
He'd be the one.
Yeah.
Now, of course, Chris Anderson then stopped speaking to you basically because you've gone over to Leeds, Steve. What was it like at Leeds? I mean, when you arrived, can you remember arriving? Fantastic. And sort of, was that the first time you'd sort of been away from Australia for a period of time?
No, not really. This is part of the, it's in the book actually as well. Yeah, you talked about my journey.
Yeah.
So at 25 years of age, I left South and Brisbane and I'd had a 3-month stint in the amateur league.
Yeah.
But it was more about my coaching. So my first coaching appointment in Brisbane was South's third grade and I was 24.
Yeah.
So a bloke called Jeff Naylor, who played for Balmain and South and East and Brisbane, he was the head coach there. I was still playing. So I was doing a 7-day job. Well, I lost my first wife out of the one, but we won't go into that.
That's the bit we wanted to go on to, wasn't it?
This is a running theme on the podcast, losing first wives. Yeah.
Well,
didn't turn to a rowing machine, did you, by any chance, Steve? Because we had Dave Woods from the BBC on the other week and he ended up on the rowing machine when he lost his first wife.
No, I was just never home. But, you know, that's where I got, I still count that period. It's probably one of the most challenging periods, both emotionally because of what was going on at home, but also with the footy. And Taz Petiri and they were doing a lot of player coach in the amateur league to go over to the UK and that.
Right.
And there was a couple of us from South, and I went, I'll go. And then he said, oh, by the way, Ando, you're coaching. So I ended up a player coach at Milton Keynes.
Do you know, I was just about to say it's Milton Keynes. I'd read this on your LinkedIn profile, Steve. I thought, Milton Keynes, really?
Yeah, thank God I was only there for 3 months, or 4 months, but it was a great experience again. And when you add them all up, you end up with depth of knowledge and experience. And
Milton Keynes is a bit like the Canberra of Australia, really, isn't it? It's very similar.
Don't worry, we're not going to insult any of our Milton Keynes fans.
I don't think we get any updates from listeners from Milton Keynes.
I enjoyed the time there.
So you turn up at Leeds, Steve, and you're thrown straight into it then, I guess.
It was a good role. It was Gary called a technical advisor. So, and there was a fair few issues off the field happening at that time. I don't know if you remember Dean Lance. And of course, I knew Dean.
Yeah, this is from Western Reds, yeah?
Yeah. So there was a few issues there. The issue actually went to court. It was over selection. Paul Sterling, I don't know if you remember that. He dropped. I think he dropped. I wasn't there, but it's
was he the winger?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's quite old. Quick. Quite quick. And but I think he was aging at that time too. He's quite old. And anyway, he never made the cut. Apparently, it turned into a racial issue.
Yeah. Yeah.
And went to court.
Okay.
So I got there just as it was sort of ending. But it was quite a tough time for Dean and his family. And, of course, the club was not a – you could tell there was something amiss.
Yeah, yeah.
When I turned up. But Gary sort of – he gave me the whole detail of what was going on. But it was a good role. It was only short term, but I was there to sort of help. Powley was there.
Did you have a technical book, Steve? Did you have something that, you know, taken from Melbourne and all your previous experience, was there something that you were physically turning up with in terms of
technical? I wrote. That's a good question, actually. I actually wrote a whole plan while I was at Leeds, and it was about what we're – Gary was quite adamant that he wanted what we were doing at Melbourne in terms of our style of play. And I said, well, there's a transition that has to happen here because our game was based on, you know, power and dominance of the middle third of the field. And once you get your momentum, then you sort of, your backs come off the back of that. But or certainly your pivots play off the back of the momentum, both sides of the field. But, you know, you need to transition. That's where your player list comes in again. You know, who you got and then what style of footy do you play. But but certainly I wrote I've still got it actually, like a manual of what we did in Melbourne and how we pieced it together. And Chris was the one that sort of was the innovator around flat line, you know, playing on the gain line. You know, then the hard part of that is to teach players about timing and delay. You know, your pivot is incredibly important, whoever that may be in that particular set. It's incredibly important that they understand, you know, when to run with momentum. Also width. We played a lot of width off our first receiver, which obviously negated, you know, 2-3 defenders before the in one pass. So, you know, I did a lot of that stuff in that period.
Actually implementing it at that point, or are you actually almost presenting, this is like, you know, almost like a consultant and advisor and saying, look, this is what you need to do.
Yeah, and Dean was very, very interested in it, obviously. A whole host of things happened then. I think from memory, I think Dean left before the end of the year, that year. In 2001, and Powley took over. So guys that were in this, I can remember guys like, so we had Bradley Clyde, Brett Mullins, the Australians, Tony Carroll. We certainly had the power, but, you know, to play flat line or on the gain line for 80 minutes, two periods of 40, and be consistent at it, it takes a lot, and you need a very, very strong bench.
Is this like a polite way of saying that Leeds are shit? Is that what you were trying to say there?
No, good. No, actually good. They just play a different style.
I presume I do this feature on our podcast, Steve.
Oh, here we go. Here we go.
Tackle bags. Yeah. And I've made a note of it just to clear it from patent pending. Is there actually a test for game IQ that you can give when you obviously arrive at a club? Does that exist?
No, match.
Excellent. Do you want this idea or shall I, can I take it? I mean, how How do you test for that? How do you sort of like, you know, you get in a room
watch,
and
you watch from the stand, Dennis, and see what they do on the park.
It's got to be done in game time. You can't do it at training either.
Mm.
There's things that you're training, no matter how hard we try to do contact at training, it's never at game speed. So obviously, if you're watching and trying to identify those that have game nous, I'd suggest we look at the games, like, and see how they perform. And the other part of it is to be able to consistently perform under pressure for long periods in a game, but also replicate that from week to week. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen Brad Fittler play a poor game.
Yeah, it's funny you should say that, Steve, because I saw him down at Collaroy a few years ago in a Thai restaurant near where I used to live. It took him about 20 minutes to order a starter. He couldn't make his mind up at all. So there you go, classic example. I mean, we've already done the foreplay, Steve. We've talked about Queensland, Western Australia, Melbourne, Milton Keynes, and Leeds. But come on, this is it now. Warrington. First and foremost, how did you end up at Warrington?
It was a discussion with Daryl Vandervelde through David Plange. Hmm. So Plange introduced me. I knew Daryl from out home, obviously, but Plange had played under him at Castleford.
Yeah.
So we had a chat. Daryl was quite influential. Obviously, he'd been there a few seasons. And
so was Daryl always going back? Was that was plan, was yeah. it, that Daryl was going to step down?
I think I was telling you this the other night, Rob. I think it was his mum.
Right. He had to go back to Australia. That was the reason. Something like family that, reasons. Yeah.
And he spent, a week with me before we sort of transitioned in.
Yeah.
But that's how it occurred. It was I went through the normal routine of applying. I had to apply for the job.
Do you know what other names were in the hat? Were you sort of privy to that at all?
Yeah. They both pulled out. I was sort of the third
Job
off the rank.
Right.
No, I was just kidding. I think there was Sean Edwards.
Yeah. So he was still, still playing? He was coming back from London then, was he? He'd sort of quit the game and was.
He quit.
Because he'd done a pre-season with London, but then apparently didn't play.
Yeah. And I think he was toying whether to go to Wales at that stage with rugby.
Yeah.
Because he's been rugby for a long time now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It was something like that, but. There was Sean and also Neil Kelly.
Widnes.
Neil took on Widnes. So, look, there's a lot of stuff there that I just wished I'd had known a lot of other peripheral.
Did you know much about Warrington and the background of Warrington when that sort of that role came along? I mean, everyone in Australia seems to know who Warrington are.
Oh, yeah, everyone knows Warrington.
Yeah.
For me to be walking around at Leeds for the first part of it, I was just, how good. Because Chris, he coached at Halifax that's why I said he was, he might have had the shits with me, but he was supportive because he knew about what I was going to come into. And, with all the shit that went on with it, it was, with my time at Warrington, it was still a great experience. And so Warrington's very well known. I'm a good mate of Graham Eadie's and Wombat gave a huge thumbs up. He played there.
Yeah, he played for Halifax. Halifax. Fabulous fullback. Yeah.
Coming to England was a no-brainer really because it fitted with a whole host of things. But I felt honoured and blessed to be even approached to come into the club. I knew it was always going to be a tough task.
Mm-hmm.
But as I said in the book, a chapter on that particular area, I just wished I would have been given a bit more information. And that's why I always blame myself around the due diligence. I let myself down in that respect.
So what questions do you think you didn't ask? I mean, we all come out of an interview and think, gee, I wish I'd asked that question. But what were the sort of prominent ones that you thought I should have asked at the time?
I just think around the philosophy. And I didn't really... Look, the fact that they had, I think they were in the throes of trying to get council approval for Halliwell.
That's right.
You could tell it was a major concern.
Yeah,
they're all all hands on deck with that.
There was a shadow hanging over the club that was sort of the prominent thing that we were trying to get right at the time.
Yeah. And I still think the money that wasn't afforded to the salary cap for me or budget was as a result of they were saving their pennies. But no, I got no doubt at all.
Yeah.
Shoestring budget, which obviously affects a lot of what you do in terms of recruitment.
Did you know it was going to be a shoestring budget when you went in? Did you?
No. And this is one of the things I say in the book.
Yeah.
It took me three or four goes to get an accurate account of what is actually the budget. There's a fair bit of argy-bargy going on.
Yeah. So at Western Reds, you knew the budget. Melbourne, you knew the budget. It was all there, black and white, same at Leeds.
It's common sense.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and to be told, three or four different figures on your budgeting, and then to find out you've got nothing really left to play with, we had to shed players.
Yeah.
Blokes like Mark Salah, Toe Curry Love, I lost David Kidwell. This is all what I look, I've never ever had a chat to Daryl about this, and I don't want it because to me it's done and dusted. But, did Daryl know? He probably did, but they couldn't afford to keep the players. There was another issue with Alfie. There was a hangover there, cost-wise.
Yeah.
So, and I think that's fairly common knowledge now that there was still money owed to Alfie when I took over.
Yeah.
That's another reason why I left.
So you took over though, Steve, and you've turned up with your and you've been very kind to actually forward us a copy of some of your plans and your strategic outlook. You've turned up. Have you signed on for 5 years, or have you signed on for a bit less than that, or what exactly? But you've turned up with a long-term vision.
How
you mentioned in your book about presenting that and having that buy-in off the board and so on. Where did you see the early signs of that dropping off from a support point of view?
I'll go back a step because this is important around that story around the plan. The reason I went into a long-term plan was a rebuild. Because I didn't have the money. If I had the money, I would have been out buying up what I could.
Buying half of Melbourne,
So I can remember working with the board and I said, look, the way to do this is, look, I know the threat of relegation's there, but what we've got to do is back ourselves to a point where we survive year one, and then we look at and reboot the following year and the following year after that. So I gave them it's a four-year projected way to do it. So it was 50% wins first year, 60, gradually build up. And you do that by being targeted with your list management and when you can afford it. This is why I had the shits with the board. Not once did they come out after they approved what I did, the long-term approach to rebuild. Not once did they come out and back me.
Do you think they got it though? Do you think they actually, that the documentation detail that you go into? All of it. The planning, you go into the academy in a lot of detail. Do you think that was just completely lost on them? Because that was something I'm sure that wasn't around the British game at the time.
I was working with guys. No, it wasn't in the British game because I went to David Waite and I ran a lot of the work by David because he was the RFL. The current national coach.
Yeah.
So I went to David and I ran everything by him and I just said, well, what do you think? I said, well, you've got to do it. If you don't do it, you're negligent. And that's the way I've always looked at it. If you don't build your underbelly, you're going to fail. You can't keep buying players in year after year and expect that you're going to get results. That's hit and miss in anyone's language. And if you win a trophy 1 year, you're more than likely, with that approach, you're more than likely to get to the bottom of the table the following year. So, what I had the shits with is the board approved it. Were they off track with the stadium and the other project? Of course they were. I understand that now. But I still would have liked support when it was getting tough. When the shit started hitting the fan, I tell you what, I was on my own.
Yeah, you've
hung out to dry.
Oh, terrible. Yeah. Terrible. I've never seen anything like it.
Did you have time to implement it, though, Steve? I mean, just this bringing in the juniors. Did you start looking at juniors in the local area and think, well, this kid and this kid? Never got that far.
What I did, I worked with the service area people. And this is fucking supposed to be coaching that. I hope you can swear. Supposed to be coaching a Super Rugby team, and here I am talking development because it hadn't been done.
Right.
So, and these are the things of where, you know, did I fail? Yeah, I did, because I took my eye off the ball. My remit was to coach a winning Warrington team. But at the same time, if I was going to be there and survive in 3 years' time, I needed succession planning happening with my underbelly coming through, you know. And look, it's a win-win for the club that way as well, because you're not forking out money. You're not forking out overs to buy in players every year, because you're developing your own. So recruitment retention starts with your development process. So, you know, I can remember talking to, I can't remember his name. I was trying to think of him today. He was the head of the development area there. I think it was Kelly. I can't think of his first name.
Neil Kelly, or
was it Alan
Kilshaw? Or was it Alan Kilshaw?
I can't remember. But I'm sitting there talking with a development officer. Yeah, okay. And then I said to him, I said, where's your planning? Well, yeah, we do this, we do that. I said, that's good, that's on the ground, but have you got anything that sort of aligns with the academy and then the super team? What language was I talking? You know, like
there was a void.
Yeah, well, the alignment's key. It's fundamental. If you don't have your underbelly sorted, your recruitment is tarnished. It's flawed. So you can't keep buying in.
So interestingly, you used a phrase maybe 10 minutes ago, having everyone on the same page. It sounds like through the club at that time, everyone wasn't on the same page. They were doing their own. They were doing their own thing.
Yeah, look, and as I said, you know, and you've probably, you know, in the book I own up, you know, I probably got too caught up in trying to fill the void or the voids that weren't being done as a professional organisation. And it should have been the general manager or, you know, some other person looking at that aspect. But I took it on because it wasn't there. And I'm, as I said, I took my eye off the ball.
Because, yourself too thin. You spread yourself too thinly across the club rather than...
Badly.
Yeah.
And tell us about the training facilities, Steve, because clearly, you know, you've come from a different world down there in Australia, mate.
His initial reaction isn't good, is it?
Was it just took and passed outside on the causeway? What were you doing?
I think, if I could say from memory, I think there's a concrete room underneath the Fletcher Street, I think there was, wasn't there?
Yeah, there was. It was a disgrace. And I can remember sitting there one day going, why me? There was no gym. They're working in a leisure centre, and I'm just going, what are we doing? Yeah. So I remember having Paulie Derbyshire in my room one day, and we're talking about the S&C side of it. I said, tell me, what are you doing? And he was using Fletcher Street. He was using the leisure centre.
Yeah.
He was using bits and pieces everywhere.
That hot tub's nice at that leather centre, though, on the villages. It's not bad. Well, it's quite nice, though.
Yeah, I call them, they're just cosmetic gyms, you know, and it's not suitable for a pro team.
And you have use of the college as well when you...
Yeah, that was a blast.
Yeah? Hey, don't you dare knock it. You know, me and Rob went there.
but not for a professional team. And, you know, like, I had a toilet beside my office, and it used to clog up all the time. Yeah, I can't remember the sponsor. No, it was Steve, the guy off the council. Steve Ailey. Brumhead. Steve came in one day and it did.
It's blocking your toilet.
It smelled like a sewer. And I apologised. Yeah, when he came in, I said, sorry, mate, it's the toilet next door. It's not me. But look,
happy days.
It was again. I openly fess up. I took my eye off the ball.
Yeah.
If I would have been selfish and just focused on the coaching and sort of done these ones.
Yeah, yeah.
And just got on with it, it would probably would have been okay, I think. But I couldn't do it. I'm not geared that way.
And the team that you had, that sort of squad that you had, the few players that I guess came up to a different level than the others, who were those players? Who were the ones that you were having to rely on to really take the team forward?
Well, at that stage, you know, we had Cut Price. And look, Nick Fizard turned out well.
He's a big lad.
Yeah, I thought he provided a fair bit of the go forward. And so did Hilton Mark. He was a surprise packet. He'd had a fair bit of time out of the game.
Yeah.
This is the problem. I went bargain hunting. Yeah. That's what I had to do. But there was a couple of guys in there like Crowther, tall winger. He'd come out of the championship. He was just, you know, they just did their job.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's all we can afford.
Yeah, yeah. So in a situation like that when you've just not got the players, I mean, in football they talk about parking the bus. You know, you get everyone back in defence. You can't do that in rugby league. Is there any tactic that you sort of can minimise the possibility of losing when you haven't got the players, Steve?
Yes, and I got berated for it. But we played Wigan.
Yeah.
And I think they beat us. It was 13-12 at half time. I think they beat us 29-12. Stuart Raper had them. And all we were doing, I said to Breezy, I said, mate, just on the fourth, just put it in the touch, turn them around. Whenever we got the ball, turn around, put it in, but put it into touch.
Yeah.
Because that obviously slows the game and it halted their momentum. And so Stuart Raper gets in the post-match conference and he goes, that's not rugby league.
Right.
But I was in damage control.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
You know, we're managing what we could. I mean, you know, Sid Domick, you know, the guys that I brought across, you know, Paul Marquette, Sid Domick, you know, Darren Burns, you know, all those guys provided, you know, their experience and they were doing okay. And Matty Rodwell, he played on a busted groin. He was getting needled. Yeah. Yeah, we're getting a game out of him every 2 weeks.
Yep.
So, you know, like some of those guys performed quite well, but it was just, we just didn't have the depth.
Yeah.
You mentioned about putting the players on notice as well in your book.
Yep.
And do you think that was a mistake?
No, we did that in, when I took over from Daryl, that's when it happened. It wasn't in the second part. It was sort of, I think it was like, I don't know, when I got there, probably mid-year or something, but Daryl was still there. And I listened to Tuera a lot, obviously, because he was in the midst of it. I spoke to a lot of the senior players to find out what the culture was. Mm. And look, you know, Tuera admitted it, he was one of the ringleaders, but there was a drinking culture.
And, no, at Warrington, no, I won't have it, Steve. Yeah.
Who was the ringleader?
He was one of the best. Okay. But so he never, you know, he could turn up the next day and play a blinder. He was one of them.
Yeah.
But, you know, there was things there that I listened to that I thought, well, we need to make some change here around our culture if we're going to compete. And, of course, this is when it was all, you know, the honeymoon period where I thought I had all this money to spend on budget for next year. Anyway. But certainly the culture was what that was about. And it was also, there were a lot of guys off contract. And it was, designed to actually, well, put yourself out there, show us what you got, you know, and then we'll go from there. But, we did get a little bit of we finished the season quite well, actually. I think we finished seventh or something. But But they could have been a lot better. I mean, and I do it, you know, for me, culture's everything.
Yeah.
You get that right, you get that everyone on the same page, that's what it leads to.
And there's a quote in your book, Steve, where you say there were issues surrounding acceptance of the change of style I had ushered in, with many of the squad failing to transition and adapt.
A lot of it was, you know, I mentioned it in there, like the unstructured, structured play. So they all, you know, everyone only leaves, you know, just wants the ball in his hand. and that's fine, that's great.
Yeah.
But we've got 13 players out there at any given time, so you have to blend in sometimes. So what I said to him was, well, let's start structured, because the structure is what you fall back when you're in the shit, so to speak. You know where you're going through the field, you know how to get there, and you know to, you know, finish a set. So we started on that. And that led to what I was trying to convince them to, that led to unstructured. So once you design your team and you give them shape and structure, from that comes the intuitive, comes the instinct. That's in the game when you have momentum. So it wasn't...
How are you teaching it, though, Steve? Is this on the... Well, it's probably on the wall with a piece of chalk or something. We didn't have a whiteboard. But is it practically done on the pitch, or is this done...
It has to be.
Yeah.
It has to be. Yeah. So, you know, contrary to Johnny Clark's comment about one passing line, fuck me. Seriously. Yeah, 13 years at NRL level, I'm fucking coaching a passing. It was all about understanding. I mentioned familiarisation before, but certainly I call it set design or set construction. So when you're teaching structured play, as I mentioned before, they need a point of reference in the field. So if you're playing percentages across the field, it might be boys, balls kicked to a left pocket. I want you to go to a right 70, which means you're going to get there in three or four, assess, and then go from there. Inside that, you've got what I call bread and butter plays. So they're the little short plays or the, you know, pass out the back. So trust me, there was a lot to pick from, but if you don't get buy-in and if it's something completely different to what they're used to, which it was, they never really adapted to systems. So the change is always hurt. It hurts, and there's always consequence. And those that, you know, struggle with it were the guys that had been in a system where I don't think there was a lot of structure.
Yeah.
That's either right, wrong, or indifferent. That's the philosophy I have. And what I was trying to do was teach them both structured and unstructured. And there's a time and a moment for both. And you need to learn both. So, you know, transition ball. You know, there's a difference between transition ball coming out of your 22 and transition ball in the attack zone.
Yeah.
And
Did Plangy adapt to this, Steve, or was he too busy doing his pilot's license at this point? Where was he coming from?
Plangy was a disciple.
Yeah.
Because he was excited about it was new. Yeah, it was innovative. It wasn't designed to restrict the talent in the team. It was designed as a safety net, and it was also allowing the instinct of the player to take over when the situation needed. But, you know, to blend those two, if you've got guys that don't want to buy into it, incredibly difficult.
Based on that, what sort of percentage of the team do you think bought into it? I mean, did you feel you were sort of out of that sort of, as I'll use a Steve Price quote now, the players group? Were you part of the players group, or did you feel they never bought into it?
Nah, never bought into it. I probably had the Australian players, without being derogatory or smart ass or whatever, they understood what I was doing.
Yeah.
But I tried to use those guys to actually integrate and engage back into the, particularly the players that had come out of championship that weren't quite up to that level. So it was a huge shock to those guys. You could see them sometimes, what are we doing? You know, like, but the other one
hoping,
was...
Yeah, you were hoping your NRL guys would be your influence within the squad almost.
Yeah, and look, you know, as I said before, if I was selfish, I could have just let it go and said, right, fellas, what were you doing last year with Daryl? I'll run off the back of that. That's not coaching.
No.
But do you think almost the British setup and the issue with the club at the time were against you because there was that fear of relegation in British sport.
Yes.
And suddenly directors get nervous. They think, we can't be playing championship rugby in our brand new spanking stadium. We need to do a need. You see it often in soccer over here. that there's a knee-jerk decision to change and these people don't keep the nerve long enough to see something through?
Well, they certainly didn't keep the nerve with me. But look, you know, I misread a lot of things.
Yeah. What would you have done different, Steve, looking back now? If you take you back now to when you arrived at the club.
Oh, I probably wouldn't have taken the job. No, look, it's...
What, with that lovely ensuite?
look, I think, as I mentioned before, philosophically was our problem. I don't think the board were... Their minds weren't on what I was doing, and neither it should be. But when you've got a project like a stadium coming up, This is where I misread it. Yeah, I was looking.
I don't think Doug Oyle would have actually understood what you were telling him, to be honest, Steve.
Dougie was funny, but look, I just Andy Gatcliffe. Look, he was the CEO. He was part time.
Yeah.
He wasn't even full time. Yeah. He was still running a McDonald's franchise.
And had Mr. Moran appeared? I think I saw a picture the other day of you and Mr. Moran in the stand together. So he was just on his way in, was he, Simon?
Simon come in and he come up to me one day. I could always remember it. He just said, "What do you need?" And I said, "How much money you got?"
Yeah.
And he said, "Well, I got a bit." And the week I stood down, I had Paul McGregor coming.
Right. Oh. He'd have been all right.
Never told anyone.
Where were you going to you're going to stick him in the centre? Where were you going to play him?
The centre.
You were going to put him in the centre, were you?
Yeah. I just said to Simon, look, I need three marquee players, but, you know, like, there's no money here. I was told there's no money.
Yeah.
But Simon had just turned up. So he said, "Oh, shit, you know, if you want to get Paul over."
So was he a breath of fresh air? Did you feel he was coming from a totally different level of professionalism when he arrived? He'd done what he'd done with his business, his music background. Look, did you feel that he was trying to sort of seep into the club at that stage?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I didn't have a lot to do with him, but he seemed to understand that, you know, what do you need? we'll go and get it for you. And I went, "Well, this is what I need." But I stood down, it wasn't long after he arrived. And then I went back into the performance director role, and I was there for about another 2 or 3 months or something. That was another cluster.
Yeah.
So Plangy took over. I didn't have a lot to do with Plangy at that stage.
Yeah.
They had to take it on their own. So Darb and Plangy sort of took over with Gary Chambers. He was good, actually, Gary. I had to separate, and obviously I knew I had to get out of there after I'd tidied up a few things. But I sort of tried to work on, you know, some reports and suggestions around where they needed to go. But obviously no one listened to long term stuff, and that's what I found. They weren't interested in the long term stuff. It was Challenge Cup and obviously
Super League.
Look,
in your book, Steve, you mention about the media and the difficult time that you had in the media and that the influence that that had. Can you go into a bit of detail of some of the issues that you had with the media?
I think it started, you know, it might sound contradictory, but I did open up my planning to the media. I showed them where I was going, what I was doing, what I intended. And remember, this is all approved by the board. I thought it was probably the right thing to do, particularly at that stage. I then knew that we're on a rebuild. Not once was that, as I said, was that word mentioned in dispatches by the CEO or anyone off the board. And I was, you know, I was pretty pissed off with it. They should have used that word. Would it have satisfied sponsors and spectators? Probably not. Probably not. But the media, in particular, The Guardian, for some reason, they're a sponsor. I used to say to Doug Hall, and I said, "Hey, I can't remember the reporter. There's one guy in particular, but it was so negative, like every week. It was negative, 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 negative.
Now, let's be honest, though. Part of your plan, and it's written in there, is the management of media and things. So,
yes,
you know, you're coming into the job and you've got an approach how to deal with the media. Where did it go wrong for you then?
Probably personalities. I think the first real incident I had with the media was young Paul Wood. And I tried to protect the kid a bit because Paul's just a young fella coming through, and I put a ban on him for the week just to ensure that he was focused on the game. And well, you think Mount Vesuvius had just erupted, like just for trying to protect. Like Woody was just a young fella coming through, I actually got inside the post match conference. Because I was going to ban the game, and some of the stuff they were writing was just ridiculous. So I'm not going to turn up the game because I couldn't interview Paul Wood. Seriously? So in the post-match, his TV picked it up as well, and I just unloaded. I just said, I said, this is about the integrity, not only the kid, but the game. I said, Paul, with all due respect, at that stage, you put a microphone under him from Sky TV or whatever, he'd stammer, he'd stutter. That's not a good advertisement for the game. Let's give the kid a bit of tuition on how to handle the media, and then you can have a shot at him, or do it in a close quarter where it's one-on-one, not in front of, viewers like TV and that, and the crowds there. But they didn't want to hear that. They just thought I was being, playing hardball. But I wasn't. I was just trying to protect the kid.
Do you think you're ahead of the game here, Steve? I mean, what you're talking now is what we see today. Do you think if you'd gone back to Warrington, if you were back at Warrington next year, do you think it would be a totally different kettle of fish in regard to the way you could have structured the club and had success with them?
I don't think I was ahead of the game. I was just, I just have a very deliberate approach around each specific component, whether it's operations or whether it's coaching or whether it's strategic intent. It's not, I said, I've learned from some very, very astute people. I mean, John Rebo's no deal. Chris Anderson's no deal. Like, say, so, that's what frustrated me. Was I looking for respect or not? No. You earn respect.
Yeah.
But, would it change what I've done now? I mean, there's a lot of water under the bridge, and I've been in rugby union a long time, but at an elite level, high performance, I would say. I mean,
I presume you use PowerPoint nowadays, Steve, rather than these 55-page documents you've got.
What about that? Incredible.
just for our listeners' point of view, Steve just sent us a couple of small little strategic detailed documents that total 77 pages. That's how detailed he is.
Well, there was actually more, I just gave a couple of snaps. But a lot of that planning, is incredibly important. I don't do anything without a plan.
Yeah.
I think perhaps, Steve, if I can just pick up on Rob's question from a minute ago, maybe you weren't ahead of your time in Australia. But over here in the British game, we weren't doing that. And actually, perhaps we can't wave a magic wand and go back. But perhaps if you'd have arrived at Warrington just 2 years later, maybe 3 years later, when the new stadium had just opened and suddenly finances were a lot stronger and suddenly the club is looking to build forward, and perhaps you would have been given more time at that point.
Never mind that, Sam. I'm still spewing about not getting Paul McGregor. I mean, that's where I'm coming from.
But it would have married your philosophy of what you were trying to do would have married in perfectly with that new era of the new stadium.
I think each moment, each appointment has its own peculiarities. I'm a stubborn bastard as well. I'm not sort of apologising for myself. What I'm saying is that I have a strong belief in what I do. Can I sell it? I failed. I failed as far as selling, concepts around the game. Did I misread you know, those people in executive positions, yeah, are given, for me, is that there's a mutual respect between coach and board and CEO. And when the chips are down, it's all three in front of, you know, the answering the questions, the curly questions. Not the middle layer. The coach is a middle layer in the organisation. The CEO is the executive, and then you've got a chairman.
So you know. If you apply your game IQ for players, do you not apply the same philosophy for coaches? Did that not make you think, actually, you know what, it needs to be a particular personality to do this job?
Yep, certainly do. And that's the philosophy and the fit, the right fit. And that's what I do differently. If I, you know, hindsight's a wonderful element or characteristic in these type of discussions. Like, would I have taken the job on if I'd known what was going to transpire? Would I have known that they have a different philosophy or a different view on things like, we're not going to tell you that the budget is, and then you go and try and spend some, so now you haven't got the money. Like, of course I wouldn't take the job on. But I didn't do my due diligence. There you go. Yeah. And I've said it in the book.
Yeah.
I failed in that respect. I failed myself. And then obviously the consequence of that is you fail the club and you fail the players. So, you know, one of the things you learn as a coach also is you got to take the good with the bad. You got to own it. So I own that period, but I own it in a way that it's a lesson learnt for me. I don't think I would have done anything different apart in that period. I just wish there would have been a more honesty there and more respect from sort of both quarters.
Yeah.
But, I just think they were off. The club itself was just so entrenched in Halliwell. I think they just, we'll let Ando go. He can sort all that stuff out on the field and we'll get the project done, the stadium.
Yeah.
Because I hardly saw him. Dougie had come in after the game, which was tough. But, and then I very rarely saw Andy Gackley. I very rarely saw him. The deputy chair, the lady, she was fantastic.
Yeah.
She was always, you know, asking, you know, is there anything we can do for you? Or, you know, how can I help? And I'd tell her how you could help, but never manifested. But
and did you settle into Warrington, Steve? When you weren't at Wilderspool, did you have time away from the club where you could just be a family and just enjoy what Cheshire has to offer?
My wife was pregnant. Which was, as I said to you the other night, Rob, that was the other sad part of it. It flowed over into the home side of it, but which was difficult, very difficult. Did we get around much? Yeah, we did. I loved England. Great spot, but I loved the culture. The casualness. I loved Yorkshire. He probably didn't like me to say that, but. I love Leeds, like that area. It was fantastic.
We're losing the signal.
But it was that there was the social side of it was quite good.
Yeah,
Dougie entertained us a couple of times.
Yeah,
his branch.
His branch.
We'll call it a ranch.
All right.
it was fine. You know, apart from. Why I was there, the purpose of why I was there, everything else was fine.
Yeah. And the players that you had at Warrington, the local lads, if you could have taken one to the NRL to nurture them into the NRL, into that Melbourne system that you'd left behind, which one would you have picked?
Clarkie.
He was the one, was he? And the reasons being?
Knew what he wanted. Fit. Did a lot of extras. Had that passion and desire, wanted to be the best.
Yeah.
And he got a lot out of what he had.
Yeah.
That overly skilled.
Yeah.
And they're my type of player.
Yeah. Okay.
Make the best of what you've got.
you know, if you've got 13 of them on the park, you're doing pretty good. Clarkey for me was one.
And then you left Warrington behind, clearly, and you went into rugby union. Was that a scar on your resume? Was that the reason you left league? Was it a case that you thought it was going to be difficult to step back in, or you were just ready for a fresh change?
Not really. I think I told you, Robert, I'd already done a little bit of work in rugby. So a couple of mates at London Irish, Gary Gold and Brendan Venter,
yeah,
a couple of South Africans, and I helped them put some of their attacking and defence through that off season. Some of the planning and all that sort of stuff, and then I'd worked in South Africa on a consultancy with Pretoria,
yeah,
the Bulls, with Heinie Meyer.
Yeah.
So I'd already had a taste, and I'd had a couple of opportunities that I declined during this period.
Yeah.
The one from Scotland had been sitting there for a little while, so I took that. So I spent 4 years up there.
Yeah.
I was the director of high performance, and also I was the defence coach as well.
And did you notice a different level of professionalism in rugby union in the UK in comparison to league? Was it
level? Yeah.
There was that you really noticed it was a step up. It was more organised.
It was obviously a different game, particularly then. I think the two games become very close now, but back then it was quite professional.
Yeah.
Even though Scotland were in a bit of trouble financially at that period, there wasn't too much that we were sort of left. Yeah, you go into a Six Nations, you know, there's not much left wanting resource wise. We had a fairly good staff. There were two periods there, two national coaches. Once again, I was recruited by some, you know, very good people, and Jim Telfer and Ian McGeeken. Both very well credentialed coaches in their own right.
Bet you didn't get an ensuite though, like you did at Wordless Bill, did you?
No, I did. I didn't have the ensuite. Yeah, working at Murrayfield, working at Wordless Bill.
Hopping for lunch in Edinburgh. Yeah, hopping for lunch in Edinburgh. Lunch round the corner to the butty shop.
Edinburgh's a terrible place.
Yeah, it's hard life, isn't it? And what took you back to Australia, Steve? Well, yeah, how long you been back there now?
Dad got sick.
Right.
When I left Scotland, I went over to a similar position in Ireland.
Yeah.
In high performance, and then I just re-signed for another 3 years. I'd spent a couple of years there, and then I re-signed for another three, and then Dad got cancer. So
sorry to hear that. That brought you back.
Yeah, so I tried to do a little bit. They left the job open for me for 8 to 10 months.
Right.
So I went home, and in the end, it's your dad.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's and I've been involved with rugby in Australia since 2012.
And do you see players in that union sport that could easily transition into league?
Today,
one thing John Clark talked about when we had him on the podcast was we signed Luther Burrell, who was possibly only getting the ball two or three times in an entire game in rugby union.
Yeah.
You know, and the guy's a big lad, and now he's sort of slimmed down to look like the rest of them at Warrington. Is that one of the problems with union? It's so specific in its positions. It's hard to transition over.
Look, your back three, if you can't kick in rugby in the back three area, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
The setters in rugby are probably more suited to our back three, mm-hmm. believe it or not, mm-hmm. if you could teach them to kick in league. Like if that's the style of player they have in union. The nine and the 10, that's like your hooker and your first receiver in league.
Yeah.
Very similar. The uniqueness of the game isn't so much in the backs, it's in the tight five.
Forwards. Yeah.
Yeah. So you got your loose head, tight head. Traditions of our game that we lost, they're still in rugby.
It's still there. Yeah. The structure's still there.
Yeah.
And you still watch league? You're still a keen league follower? And watching league now, and it's, you know, it's changed so many times, and we've had a contrasting coaches possibly over the last few years, where we've had a coach in Tony Smith who's thrown the ball around a lot, and we did have, you know, Brett Hodgson at the back, which doesn't half help when you've got a kid like that coming into the line. But we've gone to more of a, as Steve Price would say, a resilient style of footy, where we're just sort of grinding along, perhaps setting up the platforms before we do something on the fifth tackle.
Yeah.
What's your preference in terms of watching rugby league? What do you like to watch?
Not so much off the cuff. I like to see side. I like the grinding game as well.
Yeah.
When it's there, when it has to be done, the arm wrestle. And I love that battle of attrition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's how it used to be.
Yeah.
And that's what I remember, you know, as a player. And it was very physical. It was very confrontational. I love that about league. I think we've lost a bit of that.
Yeah.
But I also like the flamboyancy of the game. You know, where your halves and your back rowers are interchanging. You know, your back rowers today are like centres, you know.
Yes, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, there's nothing better than see a Greg Inglis or a, you know, even going back to Meninga, nothing better than seeing a Meninga or someone like that style player hitting a gap and then through the game. But so I like a bit of both. But what underlines me or probably defines me with the game is probably – what I mentioned before, I love that arm wrestle.
Yeah.
You know, that to-ing and fro-ing and you're winning a game in the last 5 minutes.
Yeah. We had Chris Riley on the show a couple of weeks ago and he was reflecting on the team that he'd played in the Warrington side, and he seems to think we've lost a bit of mongrel in the Warrington pack at the moment. He was talking about Morley, you know, Vinnie Anderson, these players that, you know, they've got that aggression, Benny Westwood, that can all... Yep. You know, just change your game, and we haven't got that at the moment. Do you think it's imperative that you have to have someone out on the park that's a bit of a bully?
Well, if you ever do a gap analysis on your team and you're trying to put a matrix out on what your team looks like, if you haven't got any mongrel in there, you're in trouble.
Write that down, Dennis.
Can I have that one, Steve?
Sorry, yeah, you can have that one.
Thanks. Certainly, get a mongrel.
A bit of mongrel. I mean, that's comes back to the battle of attrition.
Yeah.
You know, if you go, have got that killer in you, you shouldn't be playing collision sport. I always struggle today a little bit with some of what comes through our systems, even in rugby, because the game's so regulated now, it's actually softened the game. Well, as a consequence of that, and I'm not having a shot at the quality of the players today, but certainly some of the younger players that come through into our academies, how did you get here? You know, because as soon as you start doing contact work in the training environment, you can tell it might be a bit tentative or a bit shy.
Right.
But that's actually crept in. Whereas before, the screening process would occur naturally for those that, you know, have got that mongrel in them or that hardness of that and a robust style of footy. That had already been done by the time they get to our level.
Right.
Whereas now we're actually screening in our HP area. How did he get in there?
You touched on it before, and we're obviously very excited at Warrington at the moment because, surprise, surprise, from absolutely nowhere, Greg Inglis has signed for Warrington. Such a brilliant player, but being out of the sport for 12 months or even longer than that now, Steve, and also the fact that possibly he wasn't quite ready in his mindset to carry on playing at Souths. Do you think he can be a success in the Super League?
Without a doubt, he's probably going to come in fresh. If you think he's had a bit of time out, they interviewed him yesterday and he looked fairly hungry.
Right.
So that's good news.
Do you think that's possibly the biggest thing? Although you might not know him personally, but if he's motivated, will that be the biggest factor?
Yes. Like, he's done everything in the game. So, look, they reckon he was playing wounded for about 2 years.
Yeah.
I watched some of his games, you know, Origin time. You could tell him he just wasn't right.
Yeah.
So both physically and mentally, he's probably fresh, and he's probably motivated now to perform and go out the way he should go out. So such a esteemed career, and he had to sort of limp out of the game.
Yeah.
So I think that's a motivating factor as well. He wants to finish on a really good note. I've got no doubt if he's fresh, one quality player you got there.
Where would you play him? Would you put him in the centre just to keep him a little bit more away from the...
Fullbacks are a lot more draining on a player these days. They cover a lot of miles. I think if you want to keep him sort of, you know, fresh for attack, I'd just play him on an edge. So he's handling, you know, once in every set. But at the back, you're doing some miles these days.
Yeah.
They do it to him on purpose too. They kick away from him and make him run to the ball to return the ball. So I'd say to preserve him and get the best out of him, I'd just play him on an edge.
It's a terrible thing to say, but I was watching highlights of him on YouTube the other day. And I was like, gee, is this ever going to end? Like, it was just, you know, you get every player out there that has this wonderful showreel, because it's all very easy to put a showreel together over a period of 7 years of four things you've done right. But, you know, I've sort of watched so much of it, and I sort of click on the bottom of the YouTube channel, I've only watched a third of it. I mean, he's phenomenal in what he's achieved, and fingers crossed.
Just incredibly gifted athlete. I think that's what separates him from most. He's an athlete as well. He's not just a footballer. He's an athlete. You know, the running game that he's got is incredible.
Yeah.
And he's decisively strong. Like that fend he's got.
Yeah, 18 stone, and he fends everything off, doesn't he? And just stays in stride and goes.
So it wouldn't be a great pitcher to watch as an opponent with that bloke coming. I think you've got a very, very good buy there. Jeez.
Glenn just running off the loop. Here's a little chip from Benny Barber, tidied up beautifully by Inglis, and he gets around 1, 2, 3, 4, Greg Inglis, and he's still going. This mighty fullback for the South Sydney Rabbitohs. Will he go the distance? Greg Inglis at Suncorp Stadium. Yes, he will. What a try. Greg Inglis, you superstar.
Do you think there's a bit of difference in going back to possibly when you were at Australia and then you came over to the UK, Steve, in terms of the mindset of an Australian fan in comparison to the British fan? Because I've noticed in the last few days since he signed, there's been nothing but encouragement in the Australian press. You know, this guy's a superstar. He's coming back. Everyone respects him. A lot of the British comments I've seen from a lot of the clubs is, oh, you know, why are we signing this kid? You know, why are they bringing him over here? It seems utterly bizarre to me that they would have that concept of thinking that way.
Well, I've never been crucified so much as I was in the English media.
So
it was I think the Warrington Guardian have been positive on this one, though, Steve.
I hope so. You know, they're still the same in Australia. The media is the same.
Yeah.
If you're not winning, you know, it's a very, very brittle, you know, media and spectator. If you don't win,
You'd find it hard nowadays, because I often find myself in the coach's media room at the end of the match, and I ask some hard-cutting questions about the coaches. What advice would you give to Steve Price to manage the media?
He's been there a little while, hasn't he?
Yeah.
He knows how to handle Dennis, that's for sure. Oh, the clown's in the room again, he thinks.
Look, yes. I'm the last person to ask for advice on how to handle the media.
Yeah, I noticed it in your 77 pages. You only mentioned media three times.
I've had a few issues in my time.
And the book, Steve, there'll be a lot of Warrington fans that want to read it. We're quite highbrow here at What Would Brian Bevan Say. We forget the bigots and the hypocrites. Oh, yeah. Tell me about your book. What's going to happen in your book, and where can we buy it? Where can we read it?
Well, it's it goes out to retailers at the end of next week. It's through Tellwell Talent, but you'll be able to buy it online at any, you know, Amazon, any of those commonly used outlets. The book itself is pretty much a reflection on past experience and the lessons I've learned. Written for an audience, you know, you could probably aspiring coach would get a lot out of it. Those that want to transition into professional rugby, even executive level would get something out of it in regard to things like there's sections on, you know, the review process as an example. I look at that, and I use everything's rugby, league or union, as a backdrop. You know, and managing conflict. So they're not. It's not a coaching manual by any stretch. It's I use specific terminology around business and organisation, that occurs within all sporting organisations, particularly at a pro level. So I think even the middle manager, the executive, the HR person will probably get a little bit out of it. Where the rugby people will get a lot out of it is the story is actually based on all rugby incidences. Mm-hmm. And I've just used that as a backdrop to explain a particular experience. And also, as I mentioned before, like, you know, what did I learn from that particular experience? You know, there's a lot on the cutting floor.
So we got book two coming out soon.
Yes. there's
what's the title, Steve? You know, I mentioned the title. Yeah, are you building up to it?
A Coach's Journey.
A Coach's Journey.
And also, anyone listening to the podcast, there's a link on iTunes, there's a link on Spotify. Just click on the link. It'll take you to where you can buy Steve's book from. Steve, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on. I think we've learnt a lot tonight that possibly a lot of Warrington fans didn't realise. And it's just, you'll always be a Wyatt. You'll always be a Warringtonian. You'll always be part of the club. And we wish you all the best in the future. And thanks for coming on.
No, thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure to actually talk rugby league. It's been a while. But a memorable time. And thank you very much for allowing me to share some of those experiences.